From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. On today's episode, the Ignite series started here in Seattle in 2006, but has expanded to over 100 countries. Each Ignite event gives you, yes, you, the chance to talk about something that inspires you. What's the catch? You have to do it in 5 minutes on the stage at Town Hall. And yes, they do pack Town Hall. Ignite organizers call this an exercise in distilled discovery that leaves you with a deeper sense of the community and possibility that surround you. Their motto, enlighten us, but make it quick. This event took place at Town Hall Seattle on February 18th, 2015. The MC was writer and public speaker Scott Birkin. Thank you to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Please be advised, the following program contains some themes of an adult nature.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. Thank you very much. So, to kick us off on what should be a spectacular evening, Tara is going to talk to us about how to shake hands. Tara, come on stage.
Go get him, sir.
Hi, I'm Tara Wheeler Van Vlack. I'm the CEO of Fizment, and I'm a director of Hack the People, the world's largest tech mentorship initiative. If you're worried about your handshake, you are very smart. Handshaking is an extremely important life skill, and it's really easy to get it wrong. If you have a clammy, limp grasp that's like touching Gollum's paw, then you, my friend, have a problem. I like to call this the dead trout wiggle. It's a good reason that you might get kicked out of a job interview, and it's a reason for someone maybe to not like you without knowing why. Oh, princess shakes lead to hand kissing, and hand kissing leads to poor boundaries, and poor boundaries leads to the dark side. Or possibly just not being taken seriously in a job interview, so dark side. Bone crushers! I like to think they're just enthusiastic, but the truth is, sometimes it leads to dominance games, and you can really hurt somebody. So, plus somebody's tuning you out, trying not to wring their hand in pain for minutes at a time. Handshaking is a hugely important life skill. You communicate so much of yourself unconsciously about your character, your honesty, your trustworthiness in just a couple of seconds. So, how do we do this right? I coach and I teach a lot of women in technology, and no matter how much I teach them about dress and interview techniques, it doesn't matter if they can't give a firm handshake. A lot of people give up in frustration and they say to themselves, I'm just going to try some of these advanced techniques I see from some practitioners. Doesn't work very well. Oh God, Mitt Romney loves to cover the hand with both mitts. He likes to win at handshaking, and Clinton, well, Clinton can shake my hand any day. So, how do we do it right? Don't give up. Don't give up. Epic awkwardness can ensue when you go for the bro fist and fail it. And I like to think I've learned a little something about broing down from my brosifs. Even they don't brosplow that bad boy when they're going in for a job interview. So, here's somebody that does it right. Not Don Draper, ladies and 10% of the gentlemen in the room, but Roger Sterling. He's got a great grasp that says, I am confident and I'm kind, but I'm also really good at my job. So who does this in real life? Meet Father Ryan. Father Ryan has shaken probably 5 million hands over a 50-year career, or about the city of Atlanta. He's got the perfect handshake, and I took his handshake and the handshakes of politicians and business leaders and all kinds of folks to say, what do we do to break this down into the right handshake? I've got 5 techniques for you. The haymaker shake, hit the web, pull the trigger, squeeze the avocado in 2 pumps. There will be no 5-finger palm exploding death strike because, well, that's my next Ignite talk. Ever seen a cat still stare up when you've dropped a treat? Cats have bad up and down vision just as humans have bad front to back vision. I just put my cat in my Ignite talk and won the internet. All right. Swing it in from a 45-degree angle to cue the person where your hand is going to be. Hit the web 2 times as hard as you think you should. This is the most your force and pressure you're going to use during the entire handshake, okay? You're going to find that using an index finger just like Roger Sterling does right up here and curling it around the wrist makes it so that your hand, straight from elbow to finger point, is placed perfectly, and it really defeats those bone crushers. It's +5 defense, swear to God. So then the next thing you do is you squeeze with the same force and pressure that you would use to test if an avocado is ripe, okay? No pointy bits, just an even pressure that won't hurt the other person's hand and still lets you get a sense of what's going on under the skin. Go ahead and pump twice. Do this to the rhythm and beat of Soft Cell's Tainted Love. Dink, dink. Okay, right there. Let go. Let go at the end of it. Less time for professional, more time for deeper contact. And now I would like you all to practice. You've got 15 seconds, and I mean it. Shake the hand of somebody near you. Give it a shot. Practice it. Okay, give it a shot. Exactly. There we go. See? Say hi. Hello. Good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. We're having some fun. All right. Go ahead and bring it back on up here, folks. Thanks so much. I'm glad you're getting a chance to meet. All right, come on. Back up here. Go! Practice. Hold on. Practice. Offer honest feedback and get brutal feedback on your handshake. This is a life skill. You're going to need it forever. So work on it. Work on it during intermission. Confidence sets you apart. You communicate so much of who you are in just a couple of seconds. You're amazing. You want to make that shine through. I'm Tara Wheeler Van Vlack. Now you know how to shake hands.
Great job. Wow. I have to say, I was very nervous shaking that woman's hand. I felt very judged. Did I do okay? I think I did okay. So next up is, this is a fantastic Ignite talk title, Eating Goat Testicles and Other Feminist Activities by Morgan Beach. Come on up, Morgan.
Imagine you're all in Azerbaijan. As my grandma said to me when I went there, and maybe some of you less geographically inclined folks are thinking tonight, Azerwaristan? I'll help you out. It's a small country. It's north of Iran, south of Russia, on the Caspian Sea. And if you're picturing it in your mind, it's more like Iran than it is like Russia. It's desert, and it's dry, and it's hot, and there are weird things like mud volcanoes there. Now, I was there working with the Diplomatic Academy, doing research on internally displaced people. I lived in the capital, Baku, but I was lucky enough that I made friends, and on the weekends, those friends would take me to their hometowns, to their family summer towns, so I could see more of the country. And one particular weekend, I had a friend who took me to his hometown of Mingachevir, and we were going there because his mom had, he had just returned from America, actually. And his mom had said, if my son returns home from America safely, I will sacrifice a goat. It's really happened. And so we were going home for the goat sacrificing to his hometown of Mingachevir. And so, sorry, vegetarians, graphic goat descriptions now. But we were going there. Luckily, they had already slaughtered the goat when I arrived. And we were going to take it. We got in the car with four people, no air conditioning, 105 degrees, and the dead goat in the back. And we drove to our picnic spot in the forest in the Caucasus Mountains. And so when you do something like this in Azerbaijan, with friends and family and sacrificial goats, you eat the organs for lunch, and you eat the good meat for dinner. And it's an all-day thing. And so we were eating lunch, and some of the women got up to clean up a little bit and to make more salads and things like that. And the way I was raised, if you were a guest, you offered to help. So I got up and said, please let me help with something. And my friend said, no, you don't do that. And I said, no, please let me help. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm a guest. They're taking care of me. What wonderful hospitality. And he goes, no, you don't do that. That's women's work. And I said, but I'm a woman. He said, no, you're not. You're an honorary man. Because you're an American woman. And then his sister brought me the goat testicles to eat because I was one of the guests of honor. And so I did, the photographic evidence, I did eat the goat testicles because I wasn't quite sure what else to do. Now, I'm not famous for eating goat testicles, or my excursions in Azerbaijan, but you maybe have heard my name somewhere else lately. I'm running for Seattle City Council District 3. On a platform of gender equity. And I'd never been confronted, as in that situation, so clearly with inequality, maybe because nobody had ever said it to my face before. And I want to just sum up that experience with by saying, feminism never tasted quite so much like so. But obviously, I've been thinking about women's issues, working on women's issues for a long time. If you want to learn about the campaign, talk to me after this. This is about feminism. Now, we've had a big year and a lot of people talking about things that we clearly haven't gotten far enough in our country, in our backyard, in our city. And if you're going back and you're looking over the course of, you know, Twitter hashtags are fantastic and they're great for organized movement, but if you're looking at feminist activities and things that have really changed things for women in this country, it's in 1920 and it's getting access to the vote, and in the 1970s and getting access to birth control and abortion and getting control over our own bodies, at least when it comes to health. Now, there are two other things that I argue that we ignore too much and we're not going far enough on. And that's violence against women and it's equal pay in the workplace. I shouldn't have to walk home tonight alone with my keys clutched between my fingers because I'm afraid of what's going to happen, and I shouldn't have to work 3 months longer in my job than a male counterpart to be able to pay my rent or my health insurance or beer or whatever I want to spend my money on. Now, I want you to take this back and think about it in your everyday life and demand that you treat nobody and you are not treated like an honorary anything, but you are treated like a person.
Whew. Some good stuff. Told you it'd be a fun night. Next up, you're going to learn about one of the great masters in the history of creative work. We're going to talk about Hacking Rembrandt, Bill Ritchie.
Well, now you're going to hear about Hacking Rembrandt from an old etcher. I've been a printmaker for 50 years. And ever since I was a student, I was hacking Rembrandt. In fact, most etching students do hack Rembrandt. But when I was given a chance to talk tonight, I thought about a talk was given by Pablos Holman. Pablos works for Intellectual Ventures. He talked about hacking, and he said, hackers should probably do other things than invent the next app for an iPod, or as he called it, a fart game. In the Zeitgeist Americas of 2013. And that made me think, maybe artists should be doing something besides another masterpiece like Rembrandt did 350 years ago. Maybe artists should be thinking about working on big problems like Pablo's talked about. And so I kind of studied Amsterdam at the time of Rembrandt's life, and it's a lot like Seattle. It was a lot like Seattle. There was a lot of technology being developed. World navigation, map making, publishing, sciences, optics, all kinds of things. In particular, I was interested in printing. Artists at the time would hire printers to engrave plates to reproduce their paintings. That's how they made money. Rembrandt made a couple etchings in that manner, but he got other ideas, and so he bought his own etching press. Well, that really interested me. So I decided to write a novel, and when I researched this novel, I took a kind of time travel, put myself back in his time in 1660, and I found him, you know, working away with his press, but actually at end of his career. But he did buy his own press, and that gave him the freedom to hack etching. He took what the traditional professionals were doing, and he hacked it. He invented dry point. He worked on plates in ways that weren't done in the commercial world. Because he had his own press, he could do this. He had a mansion. He was very successful. He installed his press. He could make plates his own way, on his own terms, his own subjects. He could do really strange things. Vulgarities, no problem. Erotica, some. Beggars, homeless people. And he really liked to do his own face. He loved to do self-portraits. And I think, in a way, he was hacking his own expressions so that he maybe could give his subjects and his art a little more punch, a little more vigor by working on himself. So that was his big hack. Buy his own press, do his own etching his own way. Well, his career didn't, you know, it was a very sad time, 1660, when I visited him. But I learned that by hacking etching, as I was teaching at the UW at the time, I decided to drill down further than 350 years, 30,000 years, to the art galleries in the caves of prehistoric art. And I pictured two people working, a painter and this other person, who decided that rather than go through this arduous process of sculpting and drawing, etc., why not just put your hand on the wall and spit paint on it? And that was the invention, the root of all technology since then, the template. And the template is, in a sense, a kind of code. Again, I was teaching at the UW. I had a lot of time for doing research and thinking about these things. And I was able to bring video into the printmaking class to help me teach printmaking. But my students picked up on it. They invented video art. They did installations. They did performance pieces. They did documentary pieces. It was great. Those were the 70s and the 80s. So they were, in a sense, taking that root idea of the template and hacking it and developing other kinds of art forms. Again, it was the 80s, a hotbed of technology, both, you know, like it was in Amsterdam, here in the Seattle area. It was a real hotbed. My great hack came in the last few years when I decided to sort of reverse the process and hack the press itself. I miniaturized Rembrandt's press. I made it into a toy. It has possibilities as a game. And I think my greatest hack might come out to be making the etching press a platform for distance learning, entertainment, and art. Thanks. And let's give a big hand to Rembrandt van Rijn.
Where are you, Linda? So you just learned a whole amazing five minutes of nuggets about art history. Now maybe you're going to learn a little bit about the future of art. Next up is Katarina Countess talking about how I became a kaleidoscopist.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Katarina Countess, and I'd like to tell you about how I became a kaleidoscopist. And so I'm a graphic designer and aspiring creative technologist. What that means is that I quit my day job and work on making things full time. And some people call it art, but that often stifles the conversation instead of invigorating it. And so I like to call it making art. And you don't have to be an artist to make art. You just do a thing, and it's a thing. That's pretty cool. And so I started with self-expression because I decided what I know best is me and how to bring that out. And so I painted my face, and it got some looks. And it's just something where you look at somebody and you can see a little bit into who they are very visually, very quickly. And this is object expression, which is a different kind of art that you can make, where you take the essence of a thing and you confront it head on. And so this is an ocean harp, and it's known to sound dissonant on purpose. And accepting that you're going to be bad at something is great for when you're trying something new for the first time. This was with me and my friends, and we were just playing around, making noise, and just trying something new. And it's with this kind of confidence we can all go and make stuff with our friends that's a little weird, but also a lot of fun. And so this is when I got into kaleidoscopy. One of my friends did this first. Everyone does it first. No one's the first. And so this is me just reflecting a dance. And the cool part is the spaces between where the images meet in the mirror. That's where you can see some very interesting patterns. And that's where kaleidoscopy comes in. So kaleidoscopy is just a process that you can take to anything at all. I've taken to video, paintings, digital work, print work, all this kind of things. You just reflect it, and it looks beautiful. And it has a history and psychological work where you can see something through the patterns, and that says something about you. And this was in the 1900s when they first started doing Rorschach tests. And this was something that I did myself about 2 years ago. And so it had a reburst of interest in the 1970s and 80s when the drug revolution hit. But you don't have to do drugs to be into psychedelic art. I mean, this is Seattle too, but you can just enjoy it. And so in Japan, they're a little ahead of the game in art for a lot of different reasons, but they 2 years ago, a Japanese duo created a kaleidoscopic environment in a shipping container, and it's called Wink Space, and I highly recommend it to check it out. But also, you can do kaleidoscoping yourself. What I mean by that is a lot of my work, all I had was an iPhone and some creative software. I use Adobe Creative Suite, particularly Photoshop and Premiere Pro, but there's a lot of open source stuff that you can use too. So don't think that this costs any money. All you need is a camera and some time and a little bit of inspiration. Like this, for example. This was just a road trip me and my friends took in the summer, and we thought, wow, what a pretty picture. It's nice, right? What happens when you kaleidoscope it? You get this extra texture, this serenity, just something that you can just sit and breathe next to and just feel its precious symmetry, the awe that you feel when you look at something and you don't want to change anything about it, unless you want to change something about it. And this is me. So what you can do is you can layer it, colorize it, and distort it, and reflect it, and rotate it. And there's so many different combinations that this isn't just me. It's a movement, and you can create beauty out of things and find them in places you never thought possible. I call this one Bridge. It's one of my favorites because I didn't know it was going to happen. I just paused the kaleidoscopic video, and there it was, sitting there, as if it was waiting to be discovered. And so I want you to go out there and try it yourself and do lots of iterations. There's three things that can happen in these iterations that might be a little weird. So first, you can find beauty in something you wouldn't expect. The second thing that can happen is that you find symbols, like this. I paused my kaleidoscopic video, and I saw a cosmic owl and a cosmic butterfly, and I thought that was the coolest thing. This stuff happens just on accident, but when you stop and think about it, it's your brain that attaches patterns to it. And this is a phenomenon called pareidolia. What it means is that our human brain wants to see faces in random patterns. And this is particularly frightening. This is my experiment of ink and water, and it is shockingly horrifying. But then doing stuff on purpose like this is just shockingly beautiful. It's just something we can sit and appreciate. This was acrylic on newsprint. It took me about less than $5 to do, and it's just so relaxing to enjoy. And so that's all the time I have for today. Now go out and find something that you love and reflect it and reflect on it. Thank you.
Good job. That was fantastic. So Katerina was kind enough. A lot of her work is video, and she was kind enough to let us actually show one of her videos during the break. So up in this room during the break, you'll get to see one of her video works. So thank you, Katerina, for letting us see that. So often, I mentioned earlier on that we like to be democratic here. We want a wide range of voices and perspectives on things. So we're going to have one of the youngest speakers we've ever had give a presentation. Tori Brown's going to talk to us about how to build better humans. Tori, come on up. Go get him.
Would you like to live forever? I know, crazy question, right? But this is a question that is actually being seriously considered in a topic that's innovating biotechnology, transhumanism. Transhumanism is a campaign proving that the human body can evolve beyond its current physical or mental limitations. Let me give you some examples. I recently learned Russian in a few short months last summer. Довольно классно, не правда ли? Means pretty cool, right? But I could have learned Russian faster had I used a brain-computer interface, similar to the one used in The Matrix. I could have learned anything a lot faster in only a few seconds with this interface, which I'm sure most 15-year-olds my age would love, since our attention span is around maybe 20 minutes. Next, we have one of Japan's most popular animes, Kido Senshi Gundamu. Mobile Suit Gundam. This is a perfect example of transhumanistic technology. It's a little bit violent, but I want to get back to that. But Gundams are mainly used for violent use in the anime, but this is an endoskeleton or power jacket MK3 built by Saga Electronics in Japan. This is basically a reincarnation of a Gundam, but instead of it being a violent machine that uses nuclear power, it helps patients recover from injuries or who can't support their own muscle mass. Pretty cool, right? That's in English, not in Russian. Okay. Aren't these perfect examples of how we can teach youth science and technology from a really cool perspective? The idea is to basically take technology from science fiction shows and teach technology to young students through sci-fi shows, movies, cartoons, and more. And wouldn't that be a great way to teach young students such as myself, but not only the next generation, about science and technology? Students my age are doing terribly in national assessments around the world, and it's easy to see that the topic of science isn't taught properly in public schools here in general. So what can we do to improve interest in students and basically everyone in this country, especially for, this is for 15-year-olds, and I'm obviously a lot better at science because I wouldn't be here talking to you guys. These are basically examples of The Matrix, Gundam, Star Trek, RoboCop. These are all really, really great examples of how we can teach you science and technology. First, we have Matrix, and they talk about AI, or artificial intelligence. Basically, it's when computers can think on their own, which is actually shown with Intel's Watson. It's an AI program that recently beat the world's best Jeopardy players in 2011. Next, we have Gundam. I mentioned this earlier, but I want to make a point on this connection to real technology. A mech's main purpose, I mentioned, has a more violent use. So if we want to teach or make these robotics a mainstream invention, they must be led by the right people. Ethics are a huge factor and must be mentioned when promoting this topic. Next, we have Star Trek, or my personal favorite, The Next Generation. I love that show. Yeah. So we have Geordi LaForge. He uses a retinal implant or a heat-sinking visor, and these are now becoming a mainstream invention now, some even based on the heat-sinking visor. And then we have Data. Yay! He's a humanoid robot, and this soft-speaking android has sparked many robotic engineers into creating almost eerie, life-looking androids that walk and communicate. That's a Japanese reincarnation of the same girl sitting next to her. And then we have RoboCop. Yes, the new one and the old one that my parents used to watch. I know my mom's back there somewhere. Hi, Mom! These are perfect examples. A mortally wounded officer is saved by enhanced biotechnology and faces being rejected by society while also fighting from being hacked into by other scientists. And here we see a prosthetic built by Johns Hopkins, which is one of the best prosthetics ever. Bionicon is a campaign and a potential convention that I have started where companies that work with these technologies, as well as film producers of these movies and sci-fi shows and movies, can come together and teach youth and the next generation about science and technology. Right now, I'm planning a speech at my local high school, but Bionicon is geared towards a potentially much larger event. The idea is to combine a lecture like this one with a Comic-Con style atmosphere. I love Comic-Con. So I'm teaching you my passion, so yeah.
Great job. That was excellent. How you guys doing? Still awake? Feeling good? Yeah, we're on the home stretch for the first half. Next up is, I think, going to be a very touching and inspiring talk by Cassie Wallander about being the bigger person.
Hello. So I have been a big sister through big brothers, big sisters for 7 years. And I came here today to regale you all with facts and figures about why mentorship is important and why you should also be a mentor and why it helps kids. But instead, I decided to tell you why it helped me and share a bit of a personal story. So when I applied to be a big sister, they said, Cassie, what's important to you in your match? What do you want your little to be like? And, you know, is there any restrictions you have around age or race or religion or family situation or whatever? And I said, there's only one thing I want, and that's enthusiasm. So I got Carly, and I was super lucky because she's very enthusiastic. I met her when she was 7, and she was just joyful and excited and enthusiastic like me, and we became fast friends. We were like two peas in a pod. We spent most of our time goofing off together and laughing, and we are as close as two sisters who are 18 years apart can be. She became a very important part of my life and my family. So a couple years goes by, and the scariest thing that ever happened to me happened. I fell in love. And the reason this is scary is because I fell in love with a woman. The way I was raised, that was something that was going to set me up just for hurt and sadness and rejection. And I was terrified that I would lose my little sister. She was family, but she was voluntary family, a volunteer family. And I didn't know if I was going to still have a little sister after coming out. It took me a year to come up with the courage to come out to people, and I still remember writing that letter and being so scared and sending it with a tight knot in my stomach to Carly's mom, explaining. And as soon as I sent it, I got a phone call from her, and she said, Cassie, it's okay. We love you. It doesn't matter. You're family. And Carly will not care. She loves you, your family. So that was a beautiful moment for me. I knew that my sister would be in my life forever. And it's been 4 years since then, and Carly's mom was right. She has accepted me as I am. And she's a great kid. And she loves me for who I am. And it's made me really realize that it's important to surround yourself with friends who are your family and build a group of support around you, people who not only love you as you are, but are proud of you as you are and treat you like a normal person no matter what's going on in your life, because nobody's 100% normal. It doesn't exist. I mean, we're from Seattle. We know this. So, I threw a joke in. So, that was the big lesson for me. But it is important to mentor kids. Here's your facts and your figures. 73% of kids in Big Brothers Big Sisters are living in low-income families. And 21% of them have a parent who's incarcerated. 80% of them have fewer than two parents in their household. But the good news is they're 52% more likely not to skip school, and they're 46% more likely to not do illegal drugs. They're 82% more likely to have big plans for their education. Mentorship is a great way to make a big impact, and if you want to help kids, mentor a kid, you'll make a big impact, not just on them, but also on yourself. And my little sister is here tonight. I'd love her to come up and just say hi real quick.
Hi.
Thank you.
Great job. That was awesome.
That was pretty cool. So now we're going to do something a little weird. So when we picked the roster of speakers, we didn't know that Monica couldn't be here. So I actually had submitted a talk myself, just as little old writer Scott got accepted.
when I knew I was going to be MC, it put me in the weird situation of having to introduce myself. Which, to be honest, I do it every morning. Hey, how you doing, Scott? But that's none of your business. So I'm going to do something a little strange, okay? Over here, I'm MC and the red pants guy, guest MC. And then I'm going to move over there, and I'm going to give the talk, okay? So play along. It'll help me do a good job. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, and now Scott is going to talk about how to write about your messed up family. Okay. So when I was 8 years old, my parents separated. And when I say that, I don't mean like my mom got lost at the mall or something. I mean they separated. My father had an affair and he moved out of the house. And there was a day that I will never forget. It stayed with me all these years. I was playing in my room with Matchbox cars or something. Doorbell rang, and I thought maybe it's a neighbor or friend. I run downstairs, open the door, and I'm really surprised to see my father standing there. And he doesn't look happy. Now, understandably, this was not a good time in his life. He had good reasons not to be happy, but I looked at him. He did not look happy. I did not look happy. I did not know what the rules were. It was probably the first time he had ever been to the house since moving out. Complicated. So I didn't know what to do. We had a very strange moment for both of us, and I went and got my mom and just got out of the situation. I went back to my room, and I didn't even think about it. It did not faze me. I was 8 years old, and part of the magic of being a child is you have no context. You don't know what's weird or strange or what's going to mess you up for the rest of your life. It's not like I went into my diary and wrote, "Today is the first day of the prophecy, and 35 years from now, it is foretold that you will be in front of 500 strangers telling the story of this day." That's not what happened. And that's my first lesson for you about writing about your family, or writing about yourself, or writing about anything to do with people. And that is, our understanding of memory is really bad. Now, we operate in the world assuming we understand what we remember. That's how we understand who we are, and what we're going to do, and where we're going, and what we had to get from the supermarket or whatever. But our understanding of memory is really bad. And we believe that the past is solid, that it's fixed, it's history, and that's not true. I did not know on that day that later on in my life, that event and that moment would stay with me, and I'd think about it again and again, and it would lead me to actually write a book, in part based on that memory. So the first lesson you have to understand to write about your family is to become very curious about how memory works and how it functions. That it's not the way we think it functions. We distort memory all the time, and an event can happen late in your life that changes the meaning of the events that happened in your past. Now, my second bit of advice for you about how to write about your family is how we answer the question, who are you? We have a lot of practice in our lives answering that question. You go to a party or a bar or a job interview, who are you? And my answer, well, I'm Scott Birkin. I'm from New York. I play basketball. I write books. And we all have a lot of practice in giving that answer, but we forget that that's not a legitimate answer to the question. Who are you now? When I tell you my name is my answer, I didn't pick my name. That's something my parents gave me before they knew who I was and where I am from. Even if I'm talking about things in my past that I chose, I'm talking about that guy back there in my past, and I'm bringing the past with me into the present. And once you start writing about yourself and your family, you're going to be doing a lot of that, justifying things just because they happened. The most legitimate answer, I think, to give when someone asks you at a party, someone you've never met before, who are you? The most legitimate answer is, I don't know. I just got here. That guy was kind of stupid. Maybe you're a better person and I'll be a different person now. And to recognize that our answer to that question is based on a story from the past means you start to become open. And to write well, you have to be open and pay attention to those gaps. So my third bit of advice to you about how to write about your family is actually about the writing part. People get fixated on the romance around writing. It's what I do for a living, and the only way I'm able to do it is by being very practical about it. Writing is just making words and putting them in lines. Everything, it's just lists. A sentence is a list of words. A paragraph is a list of sentences. A page is a list of paragraphs, and on it goes. It's just lists. And the most important list for you to make, if you want to write about yourself or your family or your ex-boyfriend or your husband or whatever, a list of memories. What are the good times you remember about this relationship? What are the bad times? What are the confusing times you still haven't sorted out yet, like my story about my father? Make that list, and that list will come quickly because memories are fueled by emotion. We like to think it's photographic. It's not. It's fueled by emotion. There'll be a rush. Wow. But then you have to break down that list and use the skills of writing to get the nuances and the subtleties and the shading of what that memory means. What did that memory mean when it happened? On the day that happened, was it important? Is it important now? Why? How has it changed? And then the second question you can ask is, what were the people there thinking about that memory when it happened? What's their point of view? Because it'll end up being very different than yours. There's another thing you have to be open to write about yourself or your family, that your memory is not as accurate as you think it is. Now, the last tip I can give you about writing about yourself or your family is to read. Anyone who wants to write any kind of book should be reading books of that kind. You can absorb all kinds of tricks and tips and approaches that will help you. So my gift to you, this is my most recent book. It's about my story, my memories. It will help you if you're interested in writing this kind of stuff. There's 100 copies waiting for you on the way out. You can grab one if you want. The proceeds from the book are being donated to Big Brothers Big Sisters, which now you know why you should care about. Thank you. Now, I talked about experimentation, which is a fantastic introduction to our next speaker. Saul Villarreal, who's spoken here before, is going to talk to you about improv public speaking and you. A round of applause for Saul.
Damn, you look beautiful. All right, CDB, dolphin. There you go. Okay, so I think every single one of you tonight should give an Ignite talk at some point in your life. And I'm going to show you just how easy it can be. But to do that, I'm going to need help from an audience member in the spirit of improv. So raise your hand, first of all, if you've never been on a stage in front of this many people before. Now keep your hand raised if the idea of being up here kind of terrifies you. Now keep your hand raised high if you like doing things that terrify you. All right, I've got one enthusiastic volunteer back here. Come on down. What's your name? Oh, yeah, come on down. What's your name? Quickly.
Mary.
Welcome, yes. Mary, to the stage, everyone. Okay. So, what we're going to do here in a nutshell, we're going to get a suggestion. We're going to hear three things about you. Then the audience is going to choose which one of those three things they want to hear you talk about for 3 minutes. And then you're going to give your first Ignite talk of your life live right now tonight. So, Mary. Yeah, big round of applause. So the way this is going to work, at the end of Mary's talk, just to be polite, there's going to be a big slide that says applause. You know what to do when that happens, okay? Can I count on you? Okay. Mary, three things about you want the world to know. Come join me on the red dot.
I care about activism. Okay. I am a person who has come out after 30.
Excellent.
And I have lived in a number of continents.
I love it. What kind of activism?
Activism that promotes human dignity and the planet.
Great. All right. So we're going to repeat these three. And by the level of your applause, we're going to choose which one we want to hear Mary talk about tonight. Activism. Okay. Boop, boop. Coming out after 30. Okay. Boop. What was the last one?
Living in a number of continents other than the U.S.
Okay. Mary, in 2 minutes and 30 seconds or less, what is the one thing you want to communicate to this audience of 700 adoring people about living in a number of continents other than the U.S.? And I'll be here if you need me.
Okay, so just start going. Okay, first of all, it's awesome. You should try it. That's basically what I did with my 20s. I lived in Morocco. I lived in India. I lived in Chile. I lived in Ghana. So those are countries, not continents, and I appreciate that. Learning the local language, even a tiny bit of it, creates such an awesome connection. And I'm sure there are people in the room that have experienced that, have learned how to say please or thank you or hello, especially in a local language, an indigenous language that people don't expect you to know how to say, and then you say it, and they're like, oh. So I encourage you to do that. It's impossible to blend in and not be a white person. I tried, and it didn't work. how did I try? I tried to wear a hijab, and I think that was an interesting cultural experience, and I was still very obviously a white woman in hijab. So that led to interesting experiences. What else? Take local transportation. Local transportation is the way to see the country. Yes. If you're like really stuck and it's very, very tight, and people who have had this experience will tell you that what the sounds of farm animals sound like. So like we think that like a cow says moo and a goat says eh. But if you've ridden on public transportation where like a goat is strapped to the hood of like the vehicle, you'll know that a goat actually screams like a human child who has had this experience. Yes. Okay. So that's a good experience. Living outside the U.S. is the best way to lose your stereotypes. I basically went to Morocco after 9/11 because I wanted to know about why, not quite why they hated us. Like, I was more evolved than that, but it was along those lines. And I wanted to learn about oppression and democracy. And I basically had, like, in my first...
Thank you, Mary.
I'll meet you right down there. All right, so you see, every single one of you can do this. You all have something we want to know about. And I'll put in a quick plug for my Civic Minute. Once a week, I send out an email with everything you need to know about what happened in Seattle the previous week in 60 seconds or less. Civic Minute on Twitter.
Good job, man. That was awesome. Wow. So I know you're thinking, oh, that was staged. He picked her before. No. I was talking to Zach. I'm like, did he put a stage? He's like, nope. We wouldn't let him do it if he did. So everybody has 5 minutes to talk about. 5 minutes of a story to talk about. So next up is Brian Ono, who's a gallery owner in Seattle, and he's going to talk to you. We heard about Rembrandt. We're going to hear a broader view about how to think like an artist. Round of applause for Brian.
Imagine you're in Alaska in the dead winter, and you're landing on this remote island on a beach, and the bush pilot tells you, I hope you guys catch a few deer. I'll come back in a few days to pick you guys up. Now, this is a true story. I was an art student in college. My buddy from Alaska invited me to come up to go hunting. So the first thing I land, get on the beach, I'm just caught with the beautiful panorama. I'm just going, this is majestic. And I'm saying to myself, this is what I'm studying. I'm studying art, and this is what I need to hone in, this beauty, and transform it into a painting. My buddy taps me on the back and says, Ono, we're going hunting. Get your bag, and we're marching into the snow. So we're doing that, and soon I'm starting to realize that actually, being an artist is actually more like a hunter. And when you're a hunter, you have to hone in your senses. You have to make your eyesight better. You have to hear better. You have to smell better, taste better. And overall, trust your instinct that your gut is right in pursuing that path of finding that game you're looking for. And also be safe enough that a grizzly doesn't get you. So with that notion, later, I found myself starting to work with the glass artist, Dale Chihuly. And the first thing he would ask us to do, he said, don't come into the studio. I want you to go to a hotel lobby, a restaurant, a coffee shop, and basically sit down and think. He was a true believer in deep thinking, and he believed that it was not an innate skill that only talented people had. It was something that you honed in, you practiced. And he wanted us to do it first thing in the morning. He would wake up at 4:30. He wanted us to be in by 5:30. And we would go and sit in these lobbies taking notes. No cell phones, nothing of that sort. So with that kind of deep thinking, we're starting to push the boundaries of all these utilitarian fragments that are around us that kind of curtail our thinking, get in the way. And he wanted to free us from that. And I think artists are always thinking, how can I free my thinking that I can go beyond the typical things that are in front of me? And we hear this phrase, think outside the box. and even artists get trapped in that box. So practice. He believed that was the way to go. One of my favorite sculptors is Richard Serra. Some of you probably heard of that name if you go to the Olympic Sculpture Park. He has these huge metal Corten steel wave-like forms that are standing there. Now, he was looking for a new language. He wanted to find a form that didn't exist in nature. So he talked with his architect friend, Frank Gehry. He didn't know how to do it. He talked with mathematicians. They couldn't come up with the calculations to do these waveforms that he was trying to achieve. So he had to find a new way, and that new way was actually remarkably simple. He basically used his hand and eye coordination. He got a piece of paper, started cutting it out, folding it, and using his drawing skills, and he came up with this form. So next time, when you get a chance, walk through this huge steel Corten structure and experience. It's quite an amazing experience, I think. And I think it's these kind of permissions that we give ourselves. We don't give ourselves enough permission to say, I can be creative. We don't give ourselves enough permission to think deeply. We're so fragmented. We're encouraged to multitask. And all these things sound wonderful, but really, are they? And that's the part that I feel that when Pablo Picasso once said, all artists are born as an artist. All children are born as an artist. The problem is how to remain one once you grow up. And so we have these innate skills to be creative. If you look at a toddler, they're already jumping out of a crib. They're on the floor putting things in their mouth to feel out the world. And it's that kind of curiosity. And the curiosity asking questions. And the questions become another question. And that becomes an inspiration. And the inspiration becomes the tool for creativity. So I welcome you to think inside the box when you need to, but also think outside the box when you wish to. Thank you.
That's excellent. Just to be clear, I want you to repeat after me. I have permission to be creative. I can think for myself. Gotcha. Okay. Now, you are going to hear about a hobby that maybe you've heard a little bit about, but you're going to understand why it's a hobby that you should become a follower and be interested in. The Best Hobby You're Missing Out On by Katherine Hansen. Round of applause for Katherine, please.
So, I love anime. I've been into it almost as long as I can remember. I got into it because my best friend in kindergarten was really a huge fan of Sailor Moon. I met a lot of friends and my girlfriend through it. What most Americans know, as you can see, is some children's franchises, maybe a couple famous movies, and really weird porn. But there are a gajillion subgenres, four major genres based on demographics. Shoujo aimed at girls, shonen aimed at boys, josei aimed at women, and seinen aimed at men. But there's a lot of blurring of boundaries because anime fans don't really give a crap about if something's aimed at them, if it sounds good, you know. And a lot of creators, write with both audiences in mind, regardless of what they're technically in. While there's maybe some sexism from male fans towards female fans for critiquing or liking things that are aimed at male fans, or some guys might get crap for being into girly series, we generally share each other's toys with less problems than most nerd fandoms. So Shoujo is known for the magical girls subgenre, basically teams of girls with magic powers who fight against baddies, decadently pretty art, androgynously pretty people, explorations of gender and sexuality, and also explorations of issues that real teens face, like bullying. So kind of an interesting mix of fantasy and reality there. My favorite shoujo series is Utena, which is the best American analogy I can come up for it. is if David Lynch wrote a fairy tale deconstruction with themes of chivalry and gender, it's kind of a head trip. Its director has made a couple other later series that are also very good and worth checking out. So you should look that up. And they are also head trips. So, yeah. Shonen. Shonen is known for a lot of action, fightiness, protagonists who want to be like the best, I don't know, pirate or ninja or bread baker or whatever. Sports shows. Not so much into the real life teen issues like shoujo, which is why, yeah. My top recommendation is Attack on Titan, which is basically what happens when you combine the trappings of the zombie genre with some really interesting fantasy world building. It's kind of old Europe inspired. And it's the huge smash hit right now. It's, if you go to like any anime con, you'll see a million people dressed up as its characters. I'm hooked myself. Jose is, has a lot of, it's known for its themes of personal growth, kind of coming into your own as an adult, the one that's aimed at women. So I'm just using a tree as like a metaphor for growth. My top recommendation for it is Princess Jellyfish, which it's basically, so this huge nerd, she, well, like think, if you like Jane the Virgin for being a very specific, a show about a woman who's geeky for a very specific thing with a lot of self-awareness and weirdness, you'll probably like Princess Jellyfish. And also, if you look up Noitamina, which is animation spelled backwards, you'll find a programming block that has a lot of good Jose. Seinen. Seinen is the most prolific genre. It has the most variety. It's been become famous in recent years for having a lot of idealistic daily life series for kind of cribbing the magical girl genre from shoujo and putting its own spin on it, for making literally, being able to make literally any theme about cute, quirky girls like famous historical figures. I'd really love to see that subgenre's take on the American Founding Fathers myself. Also, its sci-fi tends to range from like really gentle, idyllic, like happy, distant future to hardcore, like gritty suspense horror dystopia, which is why my biggest sci-fi seinen recommendation is Psychopass. If you like Minority Report or basically any, you know, the dystopian genre in general, it's a really thoughtful take on its genre with an awesome lead. So I tweet and blog about anime, so feel free to hit me up for recommendations, and I'm a shameless networker, so you can hit me up on LinkedIn if you want to.
Okay, how many of you love insects? Wake up every day, more insects for me. Well, you guys are in for a treat, because your the next talk is Why Parasitic Wasps Are Awesome by Stephen Chow.
All right. So I listened to this fantastic podcast by Radiolab, and I heard Carl Zimmer talk about this jewel wasp and how it attacks a cockroach. It's like, oh my gosh, would this ever happen to a human? So hop on Google, and I typed in parasitic wasp humans, thinking, you know, hopefully I can't find something that hurts me. And, like, there's two things. Either they're farmers or gardeners, because parasitic wasps are useful, but then I found a boatload of other stuff that is so interesting. So I'm going to share with you guys three amazing parasitic wasps. First off, I'll start off with this Costa Rican parasitoid wasp. So out there, so every wasp has a very specific prey that they hunt. And for this guy, they love spiders, specifically the orb spider. And this orb spider, they weave this amazing, beautiful web. They spend like six steps to construct this web. They form the framework. They weave sticky and non-sticky parts all around it. Now, this wasp, once it infects the spider, all right, they kind of trick it. They make it high, they change its brain chemicals. Somehow, it gets the spider to spin this weird web, only repeating three steps. And it forms this web that stands up in rain. And the weird thing is, if you remove this parasite from the spider, it still does this weird little web. So it's kind of strange. Now, the next one that I would love to talk about is called the voodoo wasp. This name that I cannot say, but it induces bodyguarding, like, behavior. So its prey is this beautiful caterpillars. You know, if you mess with a caterpillar, they don't care if you pick it up. They don't really care if you put on a piece of paper. They're generally peaceful dudes. And so this wasp, you know, once it finds a caterpillar, it will lay like around 80 eggs on the poor caterpillar. You know, they kind of burrow in. They're like, oh man, caterpillar, delicious. I'm gonna eat you up. And you know, so once the egg becomes a larvae, they kind of come out. They're like, okay, it's time for us to metamorphosize into a wasp. So they come out of the caterpillar, and as you can see, the caterpillar kind of shrinks. And it stands right by the caterpillar, like, all right, I'm going to arch my back. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to sit here and watch you guys. So the interesting thing is that there's all sorts of insects. Like when the baby wasps are in this state, they're vulnerable. And anything can attack it. Like this, you know, this shield bug. The shield bug's like, I love these larvae. They come like, nom, 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 nom. What happens is the caterpillar will stand guard, and it will flail its head wildly, trying to push things away. Now, a researcher has cracked open said caterpillar, and they discovered that two larvae, or two pupae, would stay behind. So there's, you know, instead of chemicals, this wasp uses, they stay behind to watch the brood. Now, my favorite, the jewel wasp. Besides a nice, you know, beautiful coat, a jewel wasp attacks cockroaches. So let's imagine ourselves, right? Let's imagine ourselves. We're a cockroach, we're wandering around, and suddenly, out from the corner of the eye, this wasp comes out of nowhere, and I'm struggling for dear life. I'm tumbling, I'm rolling, and this wasp, with its quick reflexes, stings me twice. The first thing, through my head, it paralyzes me. Then again, it hits this very specific neurons in the brain that suddenly, which we'll explain later, like kind of freezes. So the caterpillar kind of wakes up, you know, shakes it around. It's like, okay, like I should run, but I won't. I won't run. And like this wasp, you know, goes away, digs a hole, comes back, and it like bites down on the cockroach's antenna and like pulls it along. Like on its own, the cockroach won't, like it lost its will to walk. And the wasp like pulls it along to a hole, you know, lays an egg, and boom, bada bing, a whole new wasp comes out. Now, here's the mind-blowing part about this jewel wasp. Is that as I was doing this research, apparently wasps are heavily correlated to like studying free will, which kind of blew my mind. So this wasp, yes, it puts venom in to paralyze it. It puts the venom in this other part that it knocks out only walking. It only knocks out the will to walk. But if it needs to fly, if it needs to flip to save its life, it will do that. But for some reason, it doesn't walk. So, I don't know. Maybe if someone's, like, acting kind of weird, like, perhaps they got bitten by a wasp and maybe there's something living inside them. So, hopefully I inspired you to say parasitic wasps are awesome. So, thank you.
Good job, man. Stephen has provided all of you with a little gift. If you look underneath your chair, you'll find a box of parasitic wasps that you can give to your friends or your enemies, up to you. So our next talk is going to be about the city and how our neighborhoods work, or maybe how this should work. The title of the talk is Hacking Gentrification by K.Y. King Garrett. Give him a round of applause, please.
So hacking gentrification is an invitation to reimagine the revitalization of urban African-American communities outside of the box of status quo. Some get the spoils and some get balled up and discarded like dirty tinfoil. So in doing so, we will honor the African principle of Sankofa, which is looking back to go forward. We'll be taking a trip back to the future. But we won't have a Lamborghini, but we will be pedaling real fast and hope they have bike lanes, because this is Seattle. So we honor the first black resident of Seattle, who was Manuel Lopez from Cape Verde off the coast of West Africa. He was a musician, an entrepreneur, a barber. And then he was followed by William Gross, who was an entrepreneur, hotelier, restaurateur, and pioneer who bought 12 acres of land from Henry Yesler in 1882, establishing the Central District of Seattle as a settling place for people of African descent. He was followed by many others who migrated around the First and Second World Wars, who when they came looking for a better life than the Jim Crow South, they were forced to live in the Central District as well due to covenants and other policies of discriminatory practices. And so they still made their community alongside Jewish community, Filipino community, Japanese community, and many others. And they gave us those such as the Jackson Street Jazz Legacy and Quincy Jones and Jimi Hendrix, which was epitomized or symbolized the progress by the forming of the Liberty Bank in 1968. Unfortunately, that progress did not maintain, and other policy changes, such as benign neglect, kind of changed that and redefined that community as a blight, a liability, something to be removed. And so that policy took its place, and that kind of brought us to a place a little different than our brothers and sisters and neighbors in the Pan-Asian Chinatown International District in Little Saigon area. And so we find ourselves here today thinking about how Seattle, a great city of wealth and education and resources, can own a statistic such as this. But still, all is not lost. We think about the Seahawks in the NFC Championship. Not the Super Bowl, that's a little too traumatic. And we know that there's still time on the clock, and our vision is around embracing design thinking, Africatown, and how do we source the brilliance of our community to come together to create a space and a place where the best of the African diaspora in Seattle can emanate. And we think that design thinking is a process that can facilitate that. And so the first two principles we embrace are empathy, empathize, and define. And so we empathize with the journey of those who've come, those who are still coming. And we embrace the diversity, or we define based on the strengths and the value and the richness and not the deficits. And so we think about the work happening at Africatown Center for Education and Innovation, growing the genius in our children to be the problem solvers of tomorrow. We think about the work that we've done with Hack the CD to build a startup ecosystem in the African-American community that's connected with the broader innovation tech economy. We look at opportunities such as the former Fire Station 6 and making this an epicenter and a catalyst for spreading a culture of innovation, which is not foreign to the community, because we know that Quincy Jones was an innovator. We know that Jimi Hendrix was an innovator, but somehow we missed, our community missed the connection with the innovation economy that's grown around us in tech. And we look at the opportunity to make the Midtown Plaza at 23rd and Union, Africatown Center commercial district where you can get Miss Helen's soul food, or you can get Moroccan food, or you can catch a jazz show, or hip-hop, or spoken word, all in one place. And we look at Langston Hughes, the opportunity to transition that into a community center of a cultural arts district, similar to what was just established in Capitol Hill. And we think about the resources that we have in our region, such as $210 million being proposed for a new youth jail that will incarcerate rather than unlock the genius and free the spirits in our community. And so we say this most educated city, as it's recognized, a wealthy city where there are resources. And we say, is there will? And I say, why not here? Why not now? Why not us? Let's hack gentrification. Thank you.
That was awesome. Good stuff tonight. It's good. I like it. So next up is a talk that I was started to introduce before, just to build up your temptation and excitement about it. Now you're going to hear the talk that I was talking about, which is Martina Welke is going to talk. She's a local entrepreneur. She's going to talk about the adventures of founding a business with your best friend. Round of applause, please, for Martina.
Thank you. So as you can see, I thought about many titles for this talk. And when Britta, my best friend, and I founded a business 4 years ago, we didn't know what we were getting into. But many people around us protested and warned us against it and told us it was a terrible idea. So one of the talk titles I considered was Ignore Your Grandma's Advice, because our grandmothers were particularly vocal opponents of this idea. But I didn't want to offend the grandmas in the audience, and our grandmas actually had a lot of sound data behind them. Actually, one of my favorite researchers just published a blog post about why it's a bad idea to start a business with friends and why they have such high failure rates, in fact, the highest failure rates of any business partnership. And the primary reason that they found in this research was that friends tend to put emotion in front of good decision-making. And you can imagine what avoiding conflict for the sake of someone's feelings could do for a business. It's not really a formula for success. So when Britta and I were starting out our business, we decided to set a set of ground rules. And before we started working on product or market strategy, before we started anything else, we wanted to think about our values and our goals and how those aligned with the risks we were willing to take. And that was sort of the formula that we used to set these ground rules. And we didn't think just about the degree of risk we were willing to take, but also what we were willing to risk. And what we weren't willing to risk was our friendship. We decided we wanted to prioritize and protect that in everything that we did. So we drafted the Zebra Accords, which are essentially a code of conduct, initially for us and now for our team as our organization grows. And these are the rules and expectations we set for everyone on their actions and how the expectations for treating one another. At the core of this is communication. We wanted to establish a clear and direct system for communication so that we could avoid some of the conflict that could arise from poor communication and really the heart of a lot of the problems with business, mixing business and friendship, which includes addressing the elephant in the room before he starts to swing his trunk and break things. And I can tell you a lot of stories about times we did this well, but I thought it'd be a lot more interesting to tell you about a time we failed miserably, and that would sort of illuminate my point. So about 2 years into the business, we were exhausted, and we were stressed, and we were stretched thin. It was tough. And we got together at the end of a long day to just debrief recent events. It was a dark and stormy night. And Britta started to tell me her grievances and tell me some things that, you know, were weighing on her. And through my paranoid filter, I thought my worst fear was being realized and that she was quitting the business. I heard her saying, "I'm bailing. I don't want to do this anymore." And as you can imagine, there were tears. There was drama. I freaked out a little bit. And our miscommunication was so profound that it took us a full 24 hours to realize that I had misunderstood and what had actually happened. So needless to say, it took us a little while to return to the portrait of happiness and harmony we once were. But we got there, and we learned something very important through that, that we needed to stop taking ourselves so seriously and introduce a bit of levity into everything that we did. And it's really amazing how that bit of silliness, not just between the two of us, but with our team, has opened up communication. And we took it for granted that we were fun-loving people, so fun would be had. But we realized we had to be intentional about our fun, and we had to consciously infuse playfulness into what we did. A couple of tactical tips if you're looking to infuse playfulness into your culture. I recommend choosing a mascot and costumes, both very helpful tools for introducing that little bit of levity into your own life. Because sometimes startups feel like pushing a boulder uphill only to have it roll down and smush you again and again, and you just keep getting up and pushing it up that hill. It's arduous, it's painful, it also has its moments of thrill and adventure, but there are a lot of moments where it's just sort of frustrating and humiliating. And you make the best of it. And I really ultimately disagree with the research, because I can't imagine doing this with anyone but my best friend. The trust, support, loyalty, and honesty we share is unparalleled. And the foundation that creates for our business is rock solid. And so I feel very, very grateful that I get to come to work with my best friend every day and that I get to share moments like this with her. We are officially on the clock in this photo, just so. Continue this great adventure. So I've come to believe that if you do what you love with people you love, the rest will work itself out. So thank you.
Good job. Okay. We've had lots of interesting talks tonight. A few have been about visual themes and looking closely at things and looking deeper at things. And if you liked some of those talks you've had already tonight, you're going to love this last talk of the evening. It's by Adam Philip, and he's going to talk about photographing the unseen. Round of applause for Adam.
So I take pictures off the edge of the rainbow. Infrared photographs. Now, most infrared photographers take pictures of landscapes. Lucky them. I take pictures of people. And people, they can be scary. Well, not all the time. That's a selfie I took over 25 years ago. That was an infrared film, 4x5 camera. I've since upgraded to digital. And I was hanging out in Las Vegas by the pool, itching to use my digital camera, and was thinking about what would be interesting to take pictures of. And I experimented with taking pictures of tattoos, because they show up really well. Light passes through the skin with infrared light, and it reflects back, and it doesn't care about skin tone or color, it just captures the tattoos really well. And then this guy showed up. This is Tretch from Naughty by Nature. Can we get an OPP? Never mind. Anyhow, I screwed up the courage to take his picture, and I showed him the results, and instantly he said, be sure to get a picture of my Tupac. So he'd known Tupac Shakur, and most people don't go under the needle unless this is something important to remember. He's been known to pour a shot of whiskey on his arm before a concert in memory of his friend. And while he was there, he turned to his other friend, DJ Paul, yes, from 3-6 Mafia, and said, hey, show your ink. So DJ Paul sort of shyly tugged on his shirt. I snapped this photo, and when the crowd dispersed, DJ Paul's like, hey, follow me. Normally, I don't follow guys with sort of barbed wire tattoos on their neck. But he whipped off his shirt and was like, can you get a picture of my parents? Now, these guys are kind of scary. But they're not nearly as scary as Liz. Liz and I got into a screaming match in the middle of a dance floor around the time I was taking this photograph over the artist's responsibility to their subject. I was taking pictures in a place I wasn't comfortable with, and she was like, what are you doing here? And the lessons I learned from Liz stood me in good stead when I tried to take a picture of Hohepa. I asked him first, and he refused. But then I was like, well, you know, I think you might like this. It's not often somebody's going to be walking by here with an infrared camera. And sure enough, he pulled me around the corner and said, check this out. Didn't tell me what all the tattoos mean. Taomoku have meaning. The one on the left arm is about a beautiful woman. Speaking of beautiful women, I met Erin. She was dressed all in black, had spiked boots, and was accessorized with an angry punk boyfriend who had a huge chip on his shoulder. But I knew I wanted to take her picture, so it turns out that she was kind of nice, and we planned to take some more pictures, but we haven't quite gotten around to it. That's this picture. I have it in my head. It's also a picture of Kuki. She got away because I didn't have my camera there. Well, that was until she emailed me a few weeks ago, and we got to take the pictures of her crows. That experience reminded me that these pictures were actually going out and resonating with people and coming back. And the fear started to go away. Like, if I was supposed to be afraid of anyone, this guy, his real name is Direwolf. He's an Apache with the words wagon burner tattooed on his biceps. And he and I got to play in the studio together and do some really fun art. And the beautiful thing about infrared is you can't see it. Every picture you take is a gift. It's a present. You get to unwrap it when you see it in the camera. And there's another place where gifts are common. Burning Man. So when I went to Burning Man, I was trying to decide what my gift was going to be, so I set up an infrared photo booth, and I took pictures of people. If you look closely, this is actually a selfie. But the fear doesn't always go away. I probably walked by Noni's camp for a week before I got the courage to take this photo with her. But it was worth it. We're still friends. But that gift of generosity, that present, that special experience, and I got to do it thousands of times, so much so that I went back again last year, and I do have my ticket for this year. So what I want to know is, what presents do you have to give? And so does this guy. If you've liked these photos, you can find more at Infrared Deep or irdeep.com. Thank you very much, and have a lovely evening.
Thanks for wandering over to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. If you're intrigued by the Ignite concept, maybe you can imagine yourself up there on stage at Town Hall Seattle, think about giving your own talk. You'll find a link on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Ignite Seattle 27 is coming up on May 20th, 2015. This event took place at Town Hall Seattle on February 18th, 2015. The MC was writer and public speaker Scott Birkin. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Till next time, for Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.